It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 869 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, July 7th, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. I hope you all had a very happy 4th of July. It was 28 years ago on this very day that WCW hosted its Bash at the Beach pay-per-view and changed the course of wrestling history forever, with Hulk Hogan turning heel and joining the Outsiders to form the New World Order. You know, in the history books, when it comes to truly game-changing events in wrestling history, you think of the first WrestleMania, you think of the Montreal Screwjob, you think of WCW being sold to WWE. All of these things had a very big impact on the company, on the business. Hogan turning heel at Bash at the Beach is up there among the biggest things that have ever happened to any of the major U.S. companies. And really, just the business in general was so changed by that NWO angle and everything that sprung out of it, which, of course, the Monday Night War, the Attitude Era, you know, these things don't happen. These things are not as big as they end up being, were it not for the events that took place on this day 28 years ago. The NWO is still over today. Austin 316 is still over today. There are just certain things that stand the test of time. And the NWO and this Hogan heel turn will certainly go down as an all-timer. Money in the Bank last night will not go down as an all-time memorable show, but I thought it was an excellent show, and it made some news. I'm going to talk about the fallout from last night, and I've got a review on the WrestleMania 40 documentary that finally dropped this week, plus a lot of AEW notes and a gigantic mailbag. If this mailbag was a cat, you would look at it and think, man, that cat is an absolute unit. That's the mailbag this week. So let's get to it. If you'd like to support the show, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link at the top of the page. And we had a whole bunch of people who contributed to the show this week, our PayPal producers. And I want to acknowledge them right now. I want to say thank you very much to Big B, Brian Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Night Stalker Naif, Al Safar, the Portland Pop Star, Paul Hamilton, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Road Warrior Roderick Welch, Fast Blast Tim Banks, Fight 'Em All, David Fields, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, Dark Soul, Jeff Cole, Peacemaker, Steve Cliff, all the way from the Gateway City, and Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, who just celebrated his fourth wedding anniversary on June 25th and his 35th birthday 2 days later, all in Aruba with his beautiful bride. Happy anniversary and happy birthday, Robert. I'm very jealous. I would kill to be someplace tropical right now. I guess I'll have to settle for 90 and humid in New York. It's not quite the same thing. Money in the Bank last night was an excellent show. Not a bad match to be had, although that women's ladder match, yeah, I said it last night. I quoted Dickens. How often do you hear Charles Dickens quoted on a wrestling podcast? But I said it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. That match was quite the roller coaster of emotions, mostly fear. But even that match, they won me over with those last few minutes. But the big news coming out of last night was the surprise cameo appearance by John Cena, who came out in front of the crowd in Toronto, as he did at Money in the Bank last year in London, to make an announcement. It wasn't even really an announcement. It was basically teasing a future WrestleMania in London that they may or may not get. But this year he came out and it was more personal. He announced his retirement. More specifically, he announced his retirement tour, although he said it was his retirement. The way he just kind of blurted it out, he made it sound like that was it. He was done. He had some kind of injury or illness, and he was never going to be able to wrestle again. But no, he announced his retirement tour, and he talked about how he wanted to make the announcement here, wanted to talk about Canada and Canadians and how he's been in WWE for over two decades. And one of the most impressive things is whether or not the business is hot like it is now or whether or not the business is cold. The Canadian fans can always be depended upon. The Canadian fans always show up. And they all built this to what it is today. Well, why now? It says, like Money in the Bank, it's filled with opportunity. It said Raw next year makes history when it moves to Netflix, and he will be there. He said the 2025 Royal Rumble will be his last. The 2025 Elimination Chamber will be his last. And he's here to announce that in Las Vegas, WrestleMania 2025 will be his last WrestleMania in the ring. So that will be the last WrestleMania that he actually competes in. Now, he did clarify later on in the post-show press conference that he plans to work somewhere in the range of 30 to 40 dates all throughout 2025. So he's working from January all the way through December. This is not a situation where WrestleMania is going to be his retirement match. It will be his final WrestleMania match. But that is not the end of his run. He's going to take it all the way to the end of the year. Which is kind of an important point to clarify, because I think if you watch the actual promo on the show, you didn't come away with that. You came away with, okay, it's all over for him at WrestleMania. But, you know, this was not completely unexpected. It was unexpected that it happened last night. But this was not completely unexpected, because Cena, in a lot of his interviews that he has done, has openly talked about his career winding down, and he has talked about when he hits 50, he does not plan to still be wrestling anymore. So the way he talked about it was he'll probably go until he's around 50 and then he'll call it quits. And he's, I think, 47 right now, going on 48. So it was not expected that he would come out now and tell us exactly when he was going to be calling it quits. He was the face of this company for more than a decade. Longer than Hogan's run on top there. Longer than Austin's run and Rock's run. You think of those mega runs that they had when they were at their peak. Rock's run was not that long. Austin's run was not that long. Hogan's run, you know, from the moment he came back to that company at the end of 83, won the title at the beginning of 84 from the Iron Sheik, up until the moment he left that company in 93, not even a full decade. Not even a full 10 years. And John Cena had more time on top during his run than they all did. Now, you have to put a little asterisk next to it, because that doesn't mean that John Cena was a bigger star than those men were at their peak. He wasn't. Their legacies are stronger than his. Now, you can look at John Cena differently as far as what you think his legacy is. If you think his legacy is all that he did outside the ring, if you think his legacy is the most wishes granted by anybody with the Make-A-Wish Foundation, then absolutely, he's got a bigger legacy than everybody else, maybe put together, all the wonderful things that he's done. But just going based on his career and his in-ring career and the John Cena character that we saw on TV, his legacy is not as strong as those names I just mentioned. He's up there, but it's not stronger than those men. But he was the guy that they relied on to keep their business strong for so long. Stubbornly, but he's the guy they relied on. He's the guy that Vince McMahon chose to be the face of the company, and everything was built for so many years. Everything was built around John Cena. And we had Super Cena, and it's not like he would never lose, but he would always come back. He was always so resilient. He could lose one night, lose a title one night, and then come back on Raw the next night with a big smile on his face like nothing even mattered. And then it would be on to the next feud, and every now and then there would be a guy that would come along who looked like they were building some momentum and it looked like, hey, maybe they could break through. But then Vince McMahon would stick to John Cena. He would stick to his tried and true, right? I mean, I look back at WrestleMania 30 even in the match with Bray Wyatt and all of these different examples. And that's more about bad booking or shoddy booking. And I don't even necessarily blame that on Cena. But Cena did get a lot of the blame, and he did get a lot of the blowback for it, because he was pushed so hard for so long by people who did not want to see him or that version of John Cena. John Cena was very popular for a long time as the Doctor of Thuganomics. He had a lot of edge to his character when he first debuted and picked up that gimmick. And then they kind of went PG with Cena, and they sanitized him. And that, coupled with the fact that they were just pushing him so hard for so long, is why people resented him. I don't think they hated him on a personal level, but they just got sick and tired of seeing him. He became the poster child for everything that these fans did not like and did not want to see in WWE. That's why the Boo Birds were out for him. And for so many years, it was, let's go Cena, Cena sucks. Cena was the top babyface in the company, yet he would come out on most nights and would be booed. And that just became a thing. And they were very resistant to turning him heel. I mean, we've all heard the story from Cena himself about how close he came to finally going heel in 2012 after the match with The Rock. He had new gear made, new music that he recorded. He was ready. And Vince McMahon got cold feet and said, man, we can't kill the golden goose, man. You sell a lot of merch. Heels don't sell as much merch as the babyface. And so we're left to wonder, you know, what might have been had Cena had the chance to go full on heel in 2012. So it's a very complicated legacy that he has, I think, as far as in ring and his character. You know, one of the big criticisms about him for so long was that he can't wrestle. You know, he's got his five moves of doom. Of course, everybody has their five or six moves of doom, if you think about it, right? Some people don't even have five, but it's the ones they rely on, you know, most often. But John Cena was never looked at as some great technician. He was not looked at as some great, you know, in-ring worker who can work circles around people. But he was able to go in there and do just enough to get over. It's kind of like Hogan during his run in WWF. You'd see Hogan go to Japan every now and then, and people were blown away when they saw Hulk Hogan doing a drop toe hold. It's like, oh my God, I didn't know he could do that. Well, yeah, because he wrestled in WWE for so long the way he did, because he knew he didn't have to do anything more than that. You know, back then, that's not what people came to the buildings to see in the late 80s and the early 90s. They didn't want to come see Hogan do fucking German suplexes and Huracanranas. That's not what he was there for. They wanted to see Hogan hit his moves and hit the leg drop and pose. So he was able to get away with it. John Cena, at least to his credit, he went through this weird phase. I feel like it was kind of like the mid-2010s, or like early to mid-2010s, where he was starting to incorporate some more maneuvers, including that jumping Hurricanrana. And it didn't always look great, but it's like, man, at least he's trying. You know, at least he has that sixth move of doom now. So he tried, and he had that U.S. title run, which was actually a lot of fun for all those months back in 2015. So it was up and down along the way, but you just wonder, okay, this is who Vince McMahon chose to hitch his wagon to. What would his company have looked like if he didn't have John Cena, if Cena was not able to get as over as he was? Would it have been somebody else? Because the thing about John Cena was he was very charismatic, and very few people can touch him on the microphone, even today. He was an excellent promo. I mean, there have been times over the years. The one I always think about is when they had him and Roman Reigns have a match back in, I want to say it was 2017, and they had this promo face-off, and my God, he exposed Roman so badly in that promo battle. When Cena feuded with The Rock back in 2012, heading into their WrestleMania match, their first one. Time has not been kind to The Rock on those promos. When you go back and watch it, Cena absolutely controlled this man. Cena absolutely cooked him on the microphone. And it might have been apparent to people back then, but it's even more apparent now looking back on it. That was always one of his strong suits, was his ability to communicate. His promos, when they weren't overly corny, which unfortunately they were a lot of the time, they had him out there as like the Morgan Freeman of WWE. He would come out and narrate everything that was going on at the time. Like, he was summarizing all of the stories for us. It was just ridiculous. But, you know, John Cena leaves a very big footprint in this company. And I know he is very well liked behind the scenes. He is very well respected. I think he has a lot of wisdom to impart on people in that company. He could be a great asset to them in that regard. And look, the guy is a draw even today. Because when he comes back, last time he came back, there was a noticeable bump in business through ticket sales. John Cena is a draw. And John Cena is going to be a big draw for them on this retirement tour. They're going to do big business with this in 2025. So he's working as many as 40 dates next year, again, all year long. He said that he approached WWE with the idea of doing a retirement tour, and eventually it was agreed upon that now was the best time to do it. He didn't know it was going to happen now. So he may well have been okay with doing something like this when he was 49 or 50, but they said, how about now? And he was able to make it work. He said he was in no position to pick potential last opponents. That's not something he's going to lobby for or politic for. Somebody asked him if he would be a heel during this final run, and Cena said this would be his authentic self. You know, people are going to see the real John Cena. And again, I wish people would just give up already on this whole heel turn thing. I mean, my God, it's 2024. We're talking about a John Cena retirement tour in 2025. It's not happening. You got to give it up. It's not happening. Now, I will tell you that I never thought we would see heel Rock, and we got the final boss, and it was great. So can you really never say never? In wrestling, you can never say never. I'm going to sit here and tell you I'm 99.8% sure you're not getting a heel John Cena. For a lot of different reasons. For a lot of different reasons. But if it was going to happen, they had their window, and they missed it, and that's not what this final run is going to be about. This final run is not about John Cena suddenly turning heel and showing this vicious side of him that we've never seen before and healing on the fans. What would he even say to the fans? My God, every time he comes out now, the fans, you know, they give him these rousing ovations. You know, WWE, the announcers, Michael Cole, every time he comes out, calls him the GOAT. He's the greatest of all time. What is there for him to be angry about? He's had everything. He was on top for 15 years, basically. He's won 16 world championships. He's one of the biggest names in the history of this company. He's got a successful career in Hollywood. He's got a successful television show. In fact, he took a break this weekend from filming Peacemaker Season 2. They let him go so he could come to Toronto to do this. This man has everything that a person could ask for. There's no reason for him to go heel. He also said the jorts are going to be retired. And that's it. At the end of this run, you will not see him coming out in the hat and the jorts and the t-shirt. We're going to see him in a suit and tie as a fan from now on. No physicality, no bumps, no special referee spots. Of course, every wrestler says, when I'm done, I'm done. Not taking bumps. Do I think we'll see John Cena hit an attitude adjustment at some point? Of course we will. Of course we will. Even Undertaker has said, like, When I'm done, I'm done. And we've seen him hit choke slams here and there. Not as the Undertaker Deadman, though. He did say the Deadman character is done. We will never see him dress up on WWE television again as the Deadman. And he stayed true to his word so far. Every time we've seen him, it's been just as himself. Or, you know, Biker Undertaker. So we may not see John Cena in the jorts and t-shirt, but let's be honest here. John Cena is going to be 50 years old soon. Should he really be walking around wearing the hat and the jorts and the bright colored t-shirts? I think we can retire that. Now, there was a moment during the post-show press conference where John Pollock of Post Wrestling asked Cena, he said the name. I'm not talking about Joe Hendry. He mentioned Vince McMahon. And he asked Cena what Vince has meant to his career and how he has processed what has come out about him over the last couple of years. And Cena said that he would much rather talk about what's ahead of us than what's in the past. He gave the Paul Levesque answer. Now look, when John Cena showed up at the post-show press conference, he made it very clear, like, I want you to hit me with whatever questions you got. Like, he overstayed his welcome where they were trying to kick him off so they could bring out Triple H and Punk and everybody else, and he just kept taking more and more questions. So if you are going to open yourself up to whatever questions people would like to ask of you, then you're going to get a question like that from, you know, a real journalist every now and again. I know there's not too many of those usually at these things, but, you know, Pollock asked about Vince, and he basically said to him, look, I've been honest with my opinion regarding that question elsewhere. You can probably dig it up and find it. I assume he's referring to his appearance on Howard Stern, where he had a not-so-great answer. It might have been his honest thoughts, but it was a not-so-great answer on the Vince McMahon stuff. And he basically said, you can go dig it up from there. I'm not going to get into it here. So naturally, the question now turns to, who is John Cena going to work with in his final year? Now that we know he's working the entire year, it opens him up to a lot of different match possibilities. I mean, before you were thinking, okay, he's going to wrap up at WrestleMania, so maybe he's in the Royal Rumble, maybe he has a match at Elimination Chamber, maybe there's a television match and then the Mania match and that's it. But now, if he's doing 30 to 40 dates, he could be working half the fucking roster if he wants to. Somebody had an interesting suggestion on the stream last night when I was doing my review, and I actually really like this idea. John Cena and CM Punk are forever linked. That Money in the Bank match in 2011 is one of the greatest matches in WWE history. In front of just the perfect crowd, it was the perfect atmosphere, the circumstances around that match, knowing that Punk, you know, and by that night, I think he had signed his new deal, but he legitimately was on his way out of the company. He was leaving. And they got him to re-sign, and he won the title that night, and it was a game-changing night in the career of CM Punk. You hear that expression thrown around probably too much, but that truly was a game-changer for Punk in his career. The matches that they had back then were all great. I don't think I ever saw like a really bad match between John Cena and CM Punk. Even their last match on Raw back in 2013 was an excellent match. That could have been, frankly, the WrestleMania main event that year. Or at least Punk should have been, I think, included in the match with Cena and Rock. It would have made for a better match, but they didn't do that. John Cena and CM Punk, they have to work together next year in this final run. They have to. And when Punk was asked about Cena's retirement in the scrum last night, he said the same thing. He goes, we have to wrestle again at least one more time. The suggestion that somebody made last night on the stream, and one that I support, John Cena specifically mentioned the Raw debut next year on Netflix and how big of a deal that's going to be and how he wants to be on Raw on Netflix. And I don't think that means that he's going to be exclusive to Raw. John Cena is one of these, he's a special attraction. He's one of these guys who can float. He can be on whatever show they want him to be on. Kind of like when Brock Lesnar was around. Brock Lesnar could be a potential opponent next year for Cena because I would expect him probably to be back on TV by then. But the idea of doing John Cena against CM Punk on that very first Monday Night Raw on Netflix in January, I think would be a great idea. Now you might say, well, you can build the match to do that on a PLE during the year. Maybe you do it at Money in the Bank next year. Yeah, I mean, that could work too. But man, that would be a huge attraction for that very first show on Netflix. You want to maximize the audience as much as you can for that very first show. You want to, I mean, they're going to make a big deal. That show is going to be like a PLE, I guarantee you. And they're going to have to come up with at least one big match, one big main event on that show. And we're going to see John Cena wrestling on television. He wrestled on TV the last time we saw him. It's not like they're going to just save him for the big shows. But this is a big show. And I think Cena against Punk on that first Netflix Raw would be a worthy main event, a worthy attraction for that show. And it would be kind of appropriate because the last time they wrestled was on Raw, and this could be the final time they wrestle on Raw as well, one of the biggest Raws of all time. So I like that idea, and they absolutely need to work at some point. What about other opponents for John Cena? I tweeted this last night. I said, you know, if we end up with Rock and Roman in Las Vegas next year at WrestleMania, because it's not a foregone conclusion, it's going to be Cody and Rock, even though they teased it. It could very well be that they look at Las Vegas and say, man, Las Vegas is the place to do Rock and Roman. All right, big fight city, big fight feel, big main event like that. They could do Rock and Roman at WrestleMania 41. If they do that, if they go in that direction, they table Cody and Rock for some other show. What about doing Cody Rhodes and John Cena at WrestleMania next year for the WWE Championship, assuming that Cody is still the champion at that point? I know it's a match that Cody would love to have. In fact, they were briefly on camera together on Raw once. I don't remember exactly when. I think it was last year. And they were in the aisleway, and I think Cody even on camera, like you could hear him, he whispered something to Cena about trying to get him out, you know, or get him back in the ring to do a match together. Like, Cody would love to wrestle John Cena. And Cody has actually been very close to John Cena. Cena's given him some good advice. When Cody lost in the WrestleMania main event last year, he's talked about how you know, he was down about it because he thought he was going to probably walk out with the title, and then he didn't. And Cena gave him the advice and said, look, you have to act like the champion. You have to be the champion right now without the belt. So, like, he's given Cody some good advice, and Cody respects him, and it would be a big match. Now, if it was going to be for the WWE title, that leads into the question of, do you do the title chase? John Cena is one championship win away from setting the all-time record for most world titles in WWE history. Not wrestling history, but in WWE history. They go by 16. He's tied with Ric Flair. Now, Flair didn't win 16 world titles in WWE, but they credit him with 16 world titles in his career. Cena has won 16 in this company. He's already got the record as it is. 17 would be the record. He's this close. How do you not tell that story in his final year? Right? I mean, it's kind of impossible, I think, not to at least try to tell that story. If they do, does John Cena win the Royal Rumble next year? He said this is going to be his final Royal Rumble. Now, we're assuming he'll be in the Rumble match by him saying that. If he's in the Royal Rumble match, shouldn't he win? Because I don't necessarily need to see him win the Royal Rumble match, and he's already won it twice. But if they were going to tell that story, it could be a great story to tell. And winning the Rumble one last time, he could punch his ticket to the WrestleMania main event just by winning that. Of course, he could also be in the Rumble and lose, and then he could win the Elimination Chamber. He talked about that too. This is going to be my final Elimination Chamber in 2025. Maybe he wins the Chamber. And he punches his ticket that way, and you get Cena and Cody, Cena's last chance to walk out with a title, and it would be number 17. I think there's money in that chase. Cena is not the same in-ring performer he was even 5 years ago. I mean, I've seen him in the ring. He kind of looks washed. I mean, he does the basic stuff. I mean, he can work a very basic match, but that seems like that's all you're going to get out of him. So as a WrestleMania main event, it may not be the best match, but it's a hell of a story to tell, him trying to go for that last world championship. Then there's Randy Orton. That's going to be the name naturally most people gravitate to, maybe other than Punk. You got to do John Cena and Randy Orton. My God, if I tell you my love-hate relationship with this John Cena-Randy Orton stuff, I've been doing this podcast for a very long time. And if you have stuck with me from day one when I did my first show in 2007, the number of matches that John Cena and Randy Orton had in just the period of a few years, because they haven't wrestled, I don't even remember the last match they had. It might have been 2013. That was probably the last time they had a match against each other. But just in a relatively short period of years, the number of matches they had was just astounding. And they will forever be linked because of that. And I don't look at Orton as being his greatest rival just because they wrestled so many times. I still think it's CM Punk. If I had to rank them, I'd probably go Punk, Edge, and then Orton. But they are linked together. They are linked together. I've heard Michael Cole say it's like the Austin and Rock of this generation. And it's like, that's wrong for so many reasons. I see what he's saying, but it's still wrong for so many reasons. Anytime you're going to make a comparison to Rock and Austin, you're probably barking up the wrong tree. But now it's been so long, and they're, you know, the grizzled old veterans now. You gotta do Cena and Orton in 2025. You have to. I would even say we're guaranteed to get a John Cena Randy Orton match next year. They've never had a singles match at WrestleMania, which still blows my mind. Closest thing we got was a triple threat. Never a one-on-one match at WrestleMania. The question, and I pose this to you, and you can let me know and chime in with your thoughts on this. Is it better to do it at WrestleMania? Because it is a WrestleMania caliber attraction. And the fact they've never wrestled a singles match at WrestleMania. Do you do it at 41 in Las Vegas? Or do you save it for Cena's final match? Because WrestleMania is not going to be his final match. His final match will be in December. I don't know what show they're going to have in December that you could do it on, because you got to do it on a big show. Do you make it his retirement match? Or does Cena Orton make more sense as a WrestleMania match, even if it's not his last? That's the question. I don't know. I lean more towards WrestleMania with it, but I guess I could go either way. It all depends. I mean, look, my question is, for Cena's final match, what's that going to look like? You got to make a big deal about that. Like, if he is adamant that this is it, like, I'm not coming back. Austin, right? He didn't wrestle for 19 years. Shawn Michaels was pretty adamant that he wasn't coming back until he did that one time in Saudi Arabia, but otherwise he stuck to his guns. You know, he retired in 2010. It took him 8 years to come out of retirement, but that's a long time. So let's trust that this is it for him. What do you do as an event? Like, how do you build this up? I honestly think you could do a live Netflix special. I know they got the deal with Peacock, but they also have the deal with Netflix. Why not build it up as like a live Netflix special? John Cena's final farewell. And you build that one really big final match for him, and you do a whole live Netflix special around it. I don't know if there's some exclusivity that they would have with Peacock that would not allow them to do anything other than Raw on Netflix. If so, then I guess they can't do it. But if they could, I think that's something that they should consider. You know, instead of just doing like a regular PLE, you build up a live Netflix special. You do John Cena against Randy Orton one last time. And then other opponents, I had three names I jotted down here. John Cena and Logan Paul, I think, is a match that they should do. I think they will do John Cena and Logan Paul. I think John Cena and AJ Styles, they had some great matches together. Some of John Cena's best matches were with AJ Styles. I think one more Cena-Styles match, just like one more Cena-Punk match, is something that a lot of people would like to see. And as far as like the newer names, the younger guys, man, you know, I look at that match with Austin Theory at WrestleMania last year. Boy, did that mean nothing. It, like, in hindsight, that meant absolutely nothing for the career of Austin Theory. He'll be able to say that I beat John Cena at WrestleMania and it won't mean a damn thing because they didn't follow up on it. It was such a waste of a spot for Cena looking back at it. I would hope that if they put him in the ring with another guy like a Bron Breakker or a Carmelo Hayes, that they can make it mean something this time. And I think Cena and Bron Breakker is a match that we'll probably end up seeing next year at some point. Those are the names that really jumped out at me. You know, Cody, Randy, Logan, AJ, Bron Breakker, Punk. Those are the big Cena matches that we need to get next year. Drew McIntyre won the men's Money in the Bank briefcase. As I told you, he would. The minute that he qualified for Money in the Bank, I knew he was winning it. The only question was, were they going to screw him over? Or would they screw him over later on in the show when he tried to cash in? That was really the only question, and I figured it would happen later in the show, and that's exactly what happened. But I thought it was an excellent Money in the Bank match. Everybody had a chance to shine. I know a lot of people are upset about what happened there at the end with him winning it, but we'll get to that in a second. Sami Zayn successfully defended his Intercontinental title against Bron Breakker with a Helluva kick. I was not surprised that Sami won. I picked him in my predictions. I was surprised at the fact that Bron Breakker lost clean to his finish in the middle of the ring. I wouldn't have done it that way. I don't hate it. I don't think it hurts Bron Breakker at all. I thought that he had a hell of a showing last night. That was the best match of his career. That really was. That was the best, certainly of his main roster run. That was the best match that he has had yet in WWE. Doesn't hurt to have a dance partner like Sami Zayn, who's one of the best in the world right now, and has been really for his entire career. I think Sami is a great opponent for him, but that was the best match that Braun has had yet. He's going to be just fine. In fact, I think there's still a very good chance he will walk out with the Intercontinental title at SummerSlam. So just because he got kicked in the face and pinned does not mean he is buried. It does not mean that, well, now he doesn't have the same aura that he had before. You want to know how to get the aura back that you supposedly claimed that this man lost last night? Did you see the look on his face when that match was over and they zoomed in on how he was seething sitting there at ringside? Do you remember what he did to Ricochet a few weeks ago? All it takes is one savage attack on Raw this Monday. And believe me, nobody's going to be thinking about Bron Breakker being kicked in the face and pinned at Money in the Bank. And I trust in them because they have handled him perfectly so far. So I trust that they've got a follow-up plan for him when it comes to SummerSlam. The other thing, I should go back just to the men's Money in the Bank match real quick. The other thing that surprised me, not the finish, because it played out the way that I thought it would, but I was surprised that Logan Paul was not there to screw LA Knight out of the briefcase. There was no Logan Paul at all. I mean, there was Prime logos everywhere on the screen and on the mat and on the turnbuckles. Like, his spirit was there. I'm surprised they didn't have LA Knight slip on the fucking Prime logo in the middle of the ring and hit his head and knock himself out. But there was no Logan Paul there. That surprised me. We had Damian Priest and Seth Rollins for the World Heavyweight Championship. Stipulations were that if Rollins were to lose, if he did not win the world title, then he could never challenge for it again so long as Damian Priest had that belt. And if Damian Priest lost the championship, then he would have to leave the Judgment Day. So those were the stakes coming into this match. The moment that Drew McIntyre won Money in the Bank, you knew there was going to be a cash-in, or at least a cash-in attempt. He told us. He guaranteed us. He already told us in advance. He called his shot. He said, I'm leaving Toronto as the World Heavyweight Champion. So, yeah, you knew that it was coming. Priest knew it was coming. He kept looking back over his shoulder. He was looking at the aisleway constantly throughout the entire match. And then we had the moment where Seth Rollins hit his superplex Falcon Arrow combo. And he had Damian Priest pinned, and the referee counted one, the referee counted two, and the referee held up his count even though Damian Priest did not kick out. There was no kick out. He did not get his shoulder up. I would think in a situation like that, you would at least pop your shoulder up just in case, but he didn't do that. And everybody was confused. The fans booed and chanted, you fucked up, and Rollins had a shocked look on his face. Priest was, you know, looking up at Rollins, mouthing something. I'm sure he was not happy. Because what happened here, I'm sure what happened here, is that they were waiting for the music to hit. Because 15 seconds later, Drew McIntyre's music finally hits. Or it felt like 15, but it's probably like 10 seconds later. Drew McIntyre's music hits. And out he comes for the cash-in. So what I assume was going to happen there in that spot is the music would have interrupted the pinfall. The referee would have been distracted by it. Everybody would look to the aisleway. Here comes Drew McIntyre, right when Rollins had the match won. And I think that would have fed into his anger at Drew McIntyre coming out of the match. But the way it played out, it didn't look good. It was a botch. They screwed the whole fucking thing up. Because it just looked like Rollins got screwed out of the title, which he did. And maybe they'll find a way to incorporate that now into the storyline. But unfortunately, it came off horribly. And I don't blame Damian Priest, because I think the music was supposed to hit. He was waiting for it, and it didn't happen. So somebody dropped the ball here, and I don't think it was either of these guys or the referee. And what was the referee supposed to do? Yeah, I guess they're taught to, you know, count it like a shoot. Boy, I mean, that's going to really fuck up their plans if they do that. So they were just put in a really bad position. McIntyre came out and he cashed in the briefcase. The bell rang, which made it an official cash in. And right when it looked like he was about to win this match, CM Punk attacks from behind. And he gets him outside the ring and he assaults him with a steel chair and he grabs the World Heavyweight title and he hits McIntyre in the head with it. McIntyre stumbles into a South of Heaven chokeslam, and Damian Priest, for the second month in a row, pins Drew McIntyre to retain the World Heavyweight title thanks to the assist from CM Punk. When the match was over, Rollins was obviously very angry, and he was looking at Punk, who was sitting cross-legged on the announce desk, and he started walking towards him, and he was basically yelling, you know, you get involved in my business, don't get involved in my business. He was more angry at Punk than McIntyre, although McIntyre is the one who cashed in and theoretically would have ruined what may have been the winning pinfall for him. So my point is, Seth Rollins would have beef with both of these men. He should be angry at Drew McIntyre for cashing in at the exact wrong moment, and he should be angry at CM Punk for getting involved in his business. He already doesn't like Punk. We know this. They were going to wrestle at WrestleMania this year. They're going to circle back around to Rollins and Punk, maybe sooner than we think. So he's going to have anger towards both these men. If you were watching my SmackDown review on Friday night, I told you about some news that I had heard about a little while ago. And again, this is before everything went down the way it did at Money in the Bank last night. I told you this on Friday night. I said what I had heard is that the role for Seth Rollins at SummerSlam was originally penciled in as the special guest referee. Not a match, but a special guest referee spot for the CM Punk Drew McIntyre match at SummerSlam. And it surprised me when I heard that. And I do wonder if maybe that was the plan had Seth not come back early from his injury. You know, maybe they thought, well, if he's not medically cleared to wrestle, he could be a referee. Maybe that's not the plan now. Maybe the plan is a triple threat match. But I just think they've been building for so long now to Punk and McIntyre. How are you going to make it a triple threat match? Like that needs to be a singles match. You've got to do that first match at SummerSlam. And I just think inserting anybody else into this is unnecessary. But if Rollins is going to be the enforcer, if he's going to be the referee for the match, then we get McIntyre and Punk one-on-one, but Rollins gets to be involved in some way. Looking at the way they did the finish, I just think it reinforces the idea that maybe that is the plan. Maybe the plan really is for Seth Rollins to be a referee in that match, right? Everybody keep, you know, sticking their nose in his business. Well, now he's going to stick his nose in theirs. And how's he going to play it? Because he doesn't like McIntyre, but he hates Punk. And it's not like we haven't seen this at SummerSlam in the past. They did it famously in 97 with Shawn Michaels when he was the referee for the title match between Bret Hart and The Undertaker. And he had no love lost for Bret Hart. But in the end, one wrong move ended up costing The Undertaker and Bret left with the WWF title. And there have been other special referee spots at SummerSlam in the past. So they've done it before. They could do it again here. That finish last night, I think, makes it more likely in my mind that maybe that really is what we're headed towards. I'd still be very surprised, though, if he's capable of working a match that they don't have Rollins wrestling on the show. But if you think about it, there really is no other obvious place for him on the card. Had he won the world title, he would have defended against Gunther. But now we're getting Damian Priest against Gunther. And unless they turn this into a triple threat with Punk and Drew, there is no obvious role for him on the show other than maybe being a referee for that match. So we'll see how it plays out on Monday night. I guess we won't have to wait very long to find out what direction they're going in with Seth Rollins. Outside of that one miscue, I thought that the actual match between Priest and Rollins, especially for Rollins' first match that he's had since April, was very good. But they had a very good match. The cash-in, everything here worked out exactly the way that I laid it out to you last week. And I know a lot of people are going to be upset that they wasted the Money in the Bank briefcase. Oh, they wasted it. Why would they do that? They didn't waste it. I guess I just look at it differently than you do. They didn't waste it. The Money in the Bank briefcase does not need to be utilized the exact same way every single year. You win the briefcase, you hold on to it for a month or 6 months or 9 months, and then you do the surprise cash-in and you win the world title or you don't. Why does it have to work that way? Nobody else in this match was going to successfully cash in Money in the Bank. LA Knight is going to be feuding with Logan Paul for the U.S. title. He was not winning Money in the Bank. Jey Uso was not going to successfully cash in Money in the Bank. There is no obvious time in the future, the near future that I see where this man would win the world championship on either brand. So while he's super popular, I don't think that there was really much of a point in having him walk around with a briefcase that he does not need because he is already super over. And then you have Carmelo Hayes and you have Andrade, Chad Gable. I mean, let's be honest, none of these people were going to successfully cash in Money in the Bank. It wasn't a waste of a briefcase because it fit the story that they were telling here. They needed to do it the way that they did. If Rollins is going to be involved in this in some way, then they had to do what they did. Because how else is Seth Rollins all of a sudden going to be inserted into this feud? So no, it was not wasted. They just decided to tell a different story this year that resulted in the briefcase being cashed in the same night. And that's going to irritate the shit out of a lot of people, but you got another briefcase. Guess what? There's somebody else who's going to be walking around with a briefcase on TV. If you're so infatuated with the briefcase, I'm sick to death, frankly, of these fucking briefcases and wish they would get rid of them. But no, they did not waste the money in the bank briefcase. They would have wasted the money in the bank briefcase had McIntyre cashed in and lost, and then there was no fallout from it. How many times have we seen a failed cash-in that went nowhere? Damian Sandow, failed cash-in. What did it lead to? Nothing. Baron Corbin, failed cash-in. What did it lead to? Nothing. John Cena, failed cash-in. What did it lead to? Nothing. At least here, it's going to lead to something. This is what people don't understand. Tiffany Stratton is Ms. Money in the Bank, which was the right call. And I think the favorite probably coming into the match had to be Tiffany. It was either Tiffany or, well, I mean, Tiffany, Chelsea Green was kind of the dark horse coming into this. And I said, also keep an eye on Naomi. You can't rule her out completely. But really, it was Tiffany Stratton who was going to win this briefcase. I always felt that way. I felt that way going back before Queen of the Ring. I said, if Tiffany isn't in Queen of the Ring and doesn't win Queen of the Ring, she's got to be saved for Money in the Bank. I've been saying that since at least May. And I thought, as far as the match itself, I said earlier, the best of times, the worst of times. Man, you know, I started watching this match, and those first few minutes of the match were just very rough. And there were some very scary moments. There was a Lyra Valkyria back body drop on Io Sky where she didn't really go over, that almost ended in calamity. And I don't know what the fuck Zoe Stark was trying at one point. She landed on her head on the edge of a ladder doing some kind of wacky dive back into the ring. I mean, it was just one thing after another. And I'm sitting here going, these women are going to kill themselves. Somebody's going to get killed in this match. Like, what are they doing? And they just kept getting more and more daring and more dangerous, as they do in these types of matches. To their credit, though, it got better as it went along, and they had some really crazy spots, and nobody got killed, which is good. All right, that's always a good thing. I don't think anybody got injured coming out of the match somehow. But it did improve as the match went on, and the crowd was really into it, and there was some good drama down the stretch with some of the close calls with people trying to pull down the briefcase. And even Chelsea Green had her moment there at the end. And I said it was kind of funny that Tiffany Stratton and Chelsea Green were the two fan favorites, and they were both heels in this match. But Chelsea came close. She got pushed off the ladder. She took this unbelievable bump. It could have gone so wrong if she was just 2 inches. If she would have landed 2 inches a little farther than she did, she would have smacked her head right on the barricade. But you could say that for the men and the women in these types of matches. They're always an inch or two away from catastrophe. That's why I hold my breath every time I see somebody fall off the ladder to the floor, or they do a sunset bomb onto a ladder bridge, which we had last night in the men's match with Andrade and Carmelo Hayes. Like, it's just, it's the car crash match is what it is. You know, we had that with the TNT title ladder match of Forbidden Door, where you get 6 guys in the ring and they just go balls to the wall. They just try to outdo each other. And you just hope that nobody gets hurt. You just hope for the best. It's hard sometimes to actually enjoy these matches where you just kind of feel guilty watching it. But Chelsea Green, man, she took a hell of a bump off the ladder, down through 2 tables, perfectly positioned on the floor. Tiffany Stratton pulls down the briefcase, wins Money in the Bank. Everybody cheered her like she was the biggest baby face in Toronto. And by the time this thing was over, they had won me over. I mean, they ended up having, it was the biggest spectacle of the night. It was a much bigger spectacle than the men's match was. So I will give them credit for that. But man, they were doing stuff in this match I don't ever want to see them doing again. Like, it was scary. There were a lot of very scary moments here. And they save for the main event, the 6-man tag with the Bloodline against Cody Rhodes, Randy Orton, and Kevin Owens. This was Jacob Fatu's in-ring debut. And in his in-ring debut, he no-sold a Randy Orton draping DDT. He popped right back up. Later in the match, he hit a Jeff Hardy whisper in the wind. Off the top rope, I think, wiped out Cody with it. You know, Jeff Hardy and Umaga, they had some bangers together. And if only Jeff could still go like he could back then. Imagine him coming back and working a program with Fatu. I mean, that Jeff Hardy is long gone at this point. But man, if he could work with Jacob Fatu and he was anything like he used to be all those years ago. That'd be a hell of a match. Be a hell of a program between those two. So I thought Fatu looked great last night. He didn't do too much in the way of, you know, stuff to really wow you and show you what he can do, because it wasn't called for. It was his first match. It was a wild brawl. It was his first night in. And in his first match, I thought he looked great. I thought that he looked better than Solo did as far as, you know, his in-ring performance. But it was all about Solo Sikoa and building him for SummerSlam. And they did exactly what I figured they were going to do, which is not only have the Bloodline win, but they had Solo Sikoa pin Cody Rhodes to win the match for the Bloodline. And I told you coming into this that we've seen examples of this before. I cited Shawn Michaels and Vader back in 96. Vader beat him in a six-man tag the month before SummerSlam. And that's what they did here with Solo and Cody. JM actually tweeted me and said, hey, you know, you mentioned HBK getting pinned in that six-man at In Your House by Vader, and that's what got him a championship match. He pointed out that the irony of that is that that show, that international incident, In Your House, was also in Canada. That one was in Vancouver. This was in Toronto. But that show was also in Canada, and that year's SummerSlam was also held in Cleveland. I hadn't realized that. That's actually really fucking eerie. So here we are now. We had this show in Canada, and we are heading into SummerSlam in Cleveland. Although this one's going to be in a much bigger building than that one was. So there's a lot of parallels. There's more parallels here than I even thought. So thank you to him for pointing that out. It made for a flat ending because they didn't have anything planned for the end of the show other than just Solo pinning Cody. You know, Roman Reigns, I didn't think he was going to be on the show. I didn't realize until last night that his father's funeral was yesterday. So, I mean, he wasn't going to fly from his, you know, burying his father across the border to come work Money in the Bank. That would have been ridiculous. Clearly, they're saving him for SummerSlam. So we didn't get Roman. We didn't get Jimmy Uso. There was no new member revealed, Hikuleo or anything like that. They just had the Bloodline go over, and that was it. That's how they closed the show. So it made for a flat ending, but I thought it was an excellent match. I thought up and down this card, it was excellent matches. But it was very strong Money in the Bank, but they did the ending they did because they're saving the big finale for the end of SummerSlam, which is when we are going to see the return of Roman Reigns, at least Roman Reigns. We might get the return of Roman and Heyman and Jimmy all on that show. But they are saving Roman Reigns for the end of SummerSlam, and that is going to be a very big moment. Is it the biggest SummerSlam main event they could do? No. But they're doing all they can right now to try to convince you that Solo Sikoa is a believable top guy, is a believable leader of the Bloodline, and should be taken seriously. And the way to do that is you have him beat Cody Rhodes in a six-man tag. I mean, they're hitting all the story beats that they have to if this is where they want to go with it. I wish we had a more attractive match for Cody on this show. I would have loved to have seen Cody against Randy Orton. I would have loved to have seen Cody against Jacob Fatu, but he just debuted. You're not going to have Jacob Fatu challenging for the WWE title in the main event of SummerSlam. That would be fucking ridiculous. But I thought it was a very strong show overall. Not everybody agrees based on those poll results when I put the poll up last night, but I thought it was an excellent show. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you ever find yourself comparing your life to someone else's on social media? I feel like we're all guilty of that at one time or another, especially these people or these influencers who have like hundreds of thousands or millions of followers. They're posting pictures of their fancy houses or vacations they're taking around the world. I'll be sitting here sometimes thinking, how do I get that? I want that. It's easy to envy what other people have or what you think they have, because a lot of people project happiness, but that doesn't mean they are happy. There are lots of people who live with far less who end up much happier than those who have money and nice things. Therapy can help you focus on what you want in your life rather than what others have, so you can start living your best life. Therapy can do so many amazing things for you. It can help you understand yourself better and better understand the things that are troubling you and how best to fix them or work around them. Just having someone to talk to about these things can be immensely helpful. It's okay to admit that you don't have all the answers. I don't have all the answers. I wish I did. Sometimes I think I do. And then reality smacks me in the face and I realize, boy, was I wrong. And that's okay. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to work around your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and rest easy knowing that you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Stop comparing and start focusing with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Solomonster today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Solomonster. WWE finally released the WrestleMania 40 documentary on its YouTube channel this week after promoting its release. Originally, I think it was for the week after Mania. What happened is they promoted it too early, and it wasn't done yet. They jumped the gun. But it finally dropped this week. Brian Gewirtz said that it expanded from what was originally supposed to be an 11-minute documentary to a 45-minute documentary and then to over an hour. But they obviously cut it down because this clocked in at exactly 1 hour. It focused mainly on The Rock's return and how it affected plans for the main event between Roman Reigns and Cody Rhodes, and the fan backlash that led to creative being changed to what we saw, which ended up being one of the greatest WrestleMania main events of all time. You know, basically with the whole Avengers Assemble story. That's basically what that main event was. That was WWE's version of the Avengers, taking down the ultimate bad guy in the end. It was an easy way to kill an hour, but it was basically an hour of Rock coming in, blowing up a 2-year story that people were invested in, and then taking credit as the hero who saved WWE and saved WrestleMania by graciously stepping aside so that Cody could finish his story. People online have turned Rock into a meme where he takes credit for all sorts of things now, like he's Hulk Hogan. And some of them have been really funny. I mean, think about this. Like, what they are saying here and the way they've sort of positioned this, it would be like slamming into a parked car and smashing up the whole front end and then paying to fix the damage that you caused, and they throw you a ticker tape parade for it. Like, the car may look nicer than it did before, but there was nothing wrong with the car to begin with until you fucked it up. But it also left unanswered two of the most important questions I still had coming into this. One of those questions being, what stopped them from moving ahead with their plans for Rock against Roman at WrestleMania 39? Because Rock has said publicly on the Pat McAfee show that we were locked in. We were going to do Rock and Roman in Hollywood. It was locked in. But then he and Nick Khan and Vince McMahon, they couldn't agree on the story, so they agreed to put their pencils down and table it for some other time. Yet here in the documentary, they talk about the seeds for Rock against Roman being planted almost a decade ago, when Rock held up Roman's arm after he won the Royal Rumble in Philadelphia and they got booed out of the building. They tried to trace it back all the way to that, and then later on, of course, Roman becomes the tribal chief. He starts calling himself the head of the table. So it always felt like the seeds were there if they ever wanted to do Rock and Roman. Rock scripting his scene into the Young Rock a few years ago with Young Roman telling Rock to acknowledge me and Rock saying, no, no, Dewey, or no, no, Joe, that's a match so big it can only happen at WrestleMania. You know, it felt like they were fucking with us. So the seeds have been there for a while now. If Rock was to decide that he wanted to come back one day to wrestle, it just felt like it was always going to be against Roman Reigns. And so they had the chance to do it in Hollywood, which would have been an appropriate place for it, and Rock said no. Ultimately, it was his call. It was The Rock's decision. If The Rock wanted to do the match, they would have done the match. You think WWE was going to say no to The Rock? So there was something about what they were coming up with that he did not like. What that was never explained here in this documentary, and I thought maybe they would since they brought it up again. They're the ones who brought it up, but they gave no clarity on that. Rock was positioned as the star of the documentary. Paul Levesque and Cody and Roman and Seth Rollins, they were all treated as his co-stars, basically. I thought it would have been nice to get more from Roman in this, especially after he lost the title. You know, he had this 3.5-year run. But this wasn't about Roman Reigns, it was about The Rock. It would have been nice to hear more from Seth Rollins and from CM Punk, since the Punk injury was a pretty big story and it had a direct effect on main event plans for both nights. You know, how did Seth feel when he realized that Punk was hurt and he may have lost his chance to headline WrestleMania this year? Right? Then he had his own injuries to deal with his knee. And they did briefly touch on the knee thing. They had like one scene where it showed him in a brace when he was almost ready to come back. But again, this wasn't about Seth Rollins. This wasn't about CM Punk. It was about The Rock. If it was a more complete WrestleMania documentary, they could have easily gotten 90 minutes out of it. Paul Levesque revealed that as of October, they had around 80% of the card already mapped out for WrestleMania. And it wasn't covered here, and I knew it wouldn't be, but it's crazy to think about just how much this year's Mania card was thrown into chaos, not just with The Rock and Roman and Cody and Seth and Punk, but with Gunther and Brock Lesnar as well. You know, Gunther had a legendary title run of his own going on at the time, and no doubt that Brock Lesnar would have been in the Royal Rumble to kick things off for their match, but then the Janelle Grant stuff broke that week, and Brock was pulled, and they had to come up with a new plan for Gunther. Had they moved forward with Brock Lesnar and Gunther, would Brock be the Intercontinental Champion right now? I wouldn't think so. I would like to think that they would have done the right thing and put Gunther over, but he did end up losing the title that night. So was that the plan all along? Or did they originally plan to keep it on him longer and not beat him at all until he won the world title? We may never know. You know, maybe they never even had the chance to think that far in advance. Maybe they didn't know. Triple H was put in a weird position in all this because he's the head of creative now, and he knows that they had plans to put the title on Cody this year. The minute he lost to Roman last year, he knew that we're going to run it back, we're going to have a rematch, and Cody is going to finish the story. Cody managed to stay hot throughout the rest of 2023. The fans hung with him. They stuck with him, and they had this great story. They were going to pay it off when The Rock decides, you know what? Now is the right time to come back. Not last year, now. And when they, you know, when we finally have a babyface that's over enough to take the title away from Roman Reigns after this 3.5 year run that he's been on, now he decides, after not wrestling a proper match for 11 years, this would be a great time to give the people Roman Reigns against The Rock. And Triple H admitted that sometimes a bigger match comes along that the world, you know, especially non-wrestling fans or casual fans, think is the much bigger attraction, and they're willing to pay for it and they want to watch it, and you want to go with the bigger attraction. So what do? You know, it's the question of short-term gain for possible long-term damage to your top babyface. That's the question that he had to quarrel with. The fans may have stuck with Cody after the first loss, but would they still care enough to want to see him finish the story if they pushed it back another year? Another year of hearing about finishing the story, the fucking story. I think people would have just gotten sick and tired of it. Some people already did. Would they have been able to stick with him for another year of that? There does come a point where people just get tired of hearing about it, and or they start to lose faith. They start to turn against you. You start to hear the boo birds. It's exactly what happened to him when he was in AEW. Do you take the short-term business and risk losing that story, or do you stay the course, stick with the plan, and recognize that The Rock against Roman Reigns is still going to be big box office in 2025 if you want to hold off one more year? The risk, of course, being The Rock is a busy guy. He may not be able to do it in a year. So the fact that he's available now, right, you want to strike while the iron is hot, like, I get that too. So it was a decision that really had to be thought through. But the impression you get from this is that that's a decision that was above Triple H's pay grade. Because Rock talks about going directly to his good buddies Nick Khan and Ari Emanuel to make the pitch for WrestleMania. He didn't go to Triple H, even though he's the head of creative. He went to them because they trump him in seniority. And whatever they decided, Triple H's hands were going to be tied. What if Triple H felt differently? What if he was like, man, we got this great story, Rock, let's hold off on this. He never had a chance to even make that call because he went over his head right to Nick and Ari, and whatever Nick and Ari were game for, that's what they were going to do. You weren't going to have Rock and Nick and Ari Emanuel all on the same page, and then Paul Levesque goes, yeah, you know what, I don't think so. So his hands were going to be tied no matter what. It's a very interesting power dynamic now with Rock being on the board of directors for TKO. I still feel like the minute Levesque falls out of favor with the powers that be, for whatever reason, maybe business starts to finally cool off, and there's no indication of that anytime soon, but if there's like a sudden business downturn or something, If I were him, I would be looking over my shoulder because I can see Rock running this show one day. Maybe we're talking years down the road, but I could absolutely see Rock, you know, kind of working his way in there, and he's the guy running the show. It'll be Dwayne with Brian Gewirtz as his number two. I'd be looking over my shoulder if I were Paul Levesque. Rock said that he went out there on Raw on January 1st with Jinder Mahal to test the waters when he dropped that line at the end of the promo about how maybe I should sit at the head of the table. And the fans went nuts for that tease. And that's when he knew. He said, that's when I knew. We were all systems go. They were in discussions about WrestleMania before that, though. They of course, the fans were not going to boo that announcement. He played it up like, and it wasn't even an announcement, it was a tease, but of course they were going to go nuts for it. He played it up like, I just have to know. I have to know if the fans are going to respond to that. Like, you don't go out there and drop that kind of tease unless you are committed to doing the match. So I don't buy that, well, we didn't know for sure if we were going to do it, or like, they knew. They knew. Levesque said that he told Cody the afternoon of the Royal Rumble about the new plan for Rock against Roman at WrestleMania, and he told him, don't tell anybody else, but just still play it up like you were getting the shot. Put on a happy face. You could tell just from listening to Cody in this that it was soul-crushing for him. You know, to be right there and to just feel it slipping away because the old guy is back, the old star is back to take your spot. That's a bitter pill to swallow. But they went through with their plan to have Cody win the Royal Rumble. And that was another question that a lot of people were asking. If you knew that the plans had changed, why would you not only still have Cody Rhodes win the Royal Rumble, but when he wins the Royal Rumble, you have him point up at Roman Reigns in the skybox and all but tell people that he is choosing Roman for WrestleMania? Because that's the impression you would have been left with going off the air that night. And Levesque answered that here. He said that he felt that if Cody would have lost the Rumble, it would have damaged him. So he wanted to give him the win. I don't think Cody would have lost anything being eliminated in the end by CM Punk. You know, they were the two most obvious choices. But in hindsight, boy, are they lucky they didn't have CM Punk win that Royal Rumble. They admitted that the original plan was for Punk to challenge Seth Rollins at WrestleMania for the World Heavyweight title. Punk wasn't 100% sure, but he told Ariel Helwani the same thing a few months ago, that he was of the belief that WrestleMania was going to be him and Seth headlining night one had he not gotten hurt. One thing I didn't realize at the time, but watching it again here, it really hit me watching Cody come out on Raw after the Royal Rumble and talk about how challenging the last 48 hours were for him and how the fans would never know how much he needed them on Saturday. And he said this with tears in his eyes. He was getting emotional. We didn't realize it then, but he already knew. And it was clear as day how much it was ripping his guts up inside, knowing what we still at that point did not know, which then led to SmackDown in Birmingham that Friday that turned the whole thing upside down, with Cody telling Roman that he was coming for his title, but not at WrestleMania. You know, every now and then in sports, it could be a baseball game, it could be a football game, where there's like a really embarrassing play. The kind of play that could cost your team the entire season. If the team goes on to win the game, it's forgotten about. But if they lose, it'll go down as one of the all-time greatest fumbles in history. This would have ended up on the list of all-time fumbles had they not pivoted the way that they did. It all worked out in the end, but had they dug in their heels and followed through, oh boy. This would have been an all-timer right here. Such a terrible fucking move in every conceivable way. So much so that it's hard to fathom they all sat in a room together and actually thought that it was a good idea. Some people didn't, I'm sure, but enough of them did. Let's have Cody Rhodes, after winning back-to-back Royal Rumbles and after being Samoan spiked out of the world title last year, the title that he has to win for his daddy, let's have him willingly step aside and give his spot to The Rock. Fans will love that. And it'll make Cody look too cool for school. What they should have done was have Dwayne bring a pair of Brutus Beefcake's barber shears to the ring so that he could cut Cody's nuts off in the middle of the ring. But see, then Fox would have just aired a black screen, and we wouldn't have seen it. Brian Gewirtz, he was on the Masked Man show a couple months ago, and he said that on paper, Cody's promo looked very different the way that they conceived it. He said Cody was supposed to be happy and cheerful about stepping aside. Like, yeah, fucking A, go get him, Rock. He was supposed to be on cloud nine. Those are the words he used. Cloud nine. Instead, Cody looked like someone had just shot his dog in the face in the parking lot, is what Gewirtz said. And he said that didn't help matters. He couldn't mask what he was really feeling. Yeah, you don't say. I mean, the delusion here is strong. Now, remember I said there were two questions I still had that they left unanswered? Well, the second question was, what the hell was their plan for Cody Rhodes this year had CM Punk never gotten injured and they decided to move ahead with Rock against Roman? Now, Gewirtz has said that he can say with 100% certainty that their original plan for what Cody would be doing is something that people would have hated more than anything in life. They would have hated it more than life itself. So much so that he couldn't overstate how badly this idea would have been received. That's how irate people would have been with this idea. But he never actually said what the idea was. Now, Meltzer at the time claimed that there was an injury angle planned for Cody, where coming out of the Royal Rumble, he would claim to be injured and not able to fulfill the main event spot at WrestleMania, because, you know, the winner of the Rumble gets to go to the main event of WrestleMania. He was so hurt, he is not able to fulfill that spot. And so then he would step aside willingly for The Rock to get the spot. And at least then, yeah, you say that out loud, at least then that would make some storyline sense, because he would not be medically cleared to wrestle. So the next best thing is I know somebody who knows you very well, Roman, and then Rock shows up and he takes his spot. But when Punk legitimately got hurt in the Royal Rumble, they didn't want to have two injuries at the same time. So they dropped the injury angle. So maybe that's it. The idea they would have gone with is they would take Cody Rhodes off the WrestleMania card completely with a phony injury when he really wasn't hurt. If that's true, then yeah, I would say that would piss off a lot of people, including Cody. If that's true. I mean, in the documentary, Cody asks, like, where does that leave me for WrestleMania now? And Levesque tells him, not sure yet. Imagine telling your top babyface that you've been building for really 2 years, let alone, you know, just that entire year, but really 2 years. And imagine telling that person 2 months before WrestleMania, don't know, not sure yet. We'll have to get back to you on that. But Punk did get hurt. And the idea was to go to Cody and Rollins instead for the World Heavyweight title, even though that was not the title that Dusty fought for. And Cody openly had said, like, hey, I have all the respect in the world for the World Heavyweight Championship, but that title is not my goal. Like, I can't finish the story with that belt. So, of course, they do the segment. The backlash came fast and furious. See what I did there? First, it came online. Then it came at the live events, at the shows. Rock was getting booed whenever his name was mentioned. There were We Want Cody signs. We Want Cody trended for 72 hours straight after that SmackDown. Rock says it bugged the shit out of him that there was even a small segment, let alone a big segment, of the fans that were upset. He couldn't stand knowing that there were fans who were upset. I think it's the tone deafness of it all that still surprises me, that somebody as savvy as The Rock is, or I thought was, wouldn't realize the way they handled the Cody part of it, that it wouldn't blow up at his face. You know, when Triple H was on Logan Paul's show a few months ago, he admitted that he knew. Because Logan asked him, like, did you expect this kind of reaction from the fans? Did you expect this backlash? And he didn't hesitate. He goes, yeah. He goes, I knew. Like, I was expecting it. But that just goes to show you, you know, Rock is going to get what The Rock wants. Rock wanted Roman. He was going to get Roman. He went to Nick Khan. He went to Ari Emanuel. He said, I got this great idea. And they were all gung-ho for it, and that was it. And Triple H was just going to have to figure it out as they went along. He was going to have to figure out a way to have it all make sense. So Rock says that it was his call to make the pivot and that the fans needed Cody to finish his story. And then he says he came up with the idea to go heel and become the final boss, which really was the best for all involved. They took a great situation they already had, they made it worse, but then they found a way to make it even better. And Rock does deserve credit for being open to switching things up, whether he genuinely realized he made a mistake, or he only did what he did to save face. I mean, whatever you believe, I'm sure there was a lot of ego involved in this thing from start to finish. But in the end, he did the right thing, and we ended up with something special with that final boss character. I never thought that we would see heel Rock again. I don't think Rock ever thought that he would see heel Rock again. But heel Rock is what we got. And when he comes back, I'm not so sure that he won't be a babyface initially when he comes back. You know, because he and Roman Reigns, they were on the same side. So maybe the next time we see The Rock, it's side by side with Roman against Solo's bloodline. I mean, in the very unlikely event that Rock actually does come back to wrestle in a War Games match, and I just don't see him coming back for anything but WrestleMania, but let's say he does, you have Rock, Roman, and the Usos against Solo, Jacob, Tama Tonga, Tonga Loa. And then Rock betrays Roman and goes heel again to set up Rock against Roman for Las Vegas next year. And they save Rock and Cody for some other time. Like, there's so many different ways this bloodline story can go. That's what's so great about the way they've set this thing up now. They've done a great job with it. But they came up with the idea to have the tag team match on night one feed into the main event on night two, and we got our fourth straight WrestleMania ending in zero with the underdog babyface winning the world title. First it was Bret Hart, then it was Chris Benoit, then it was Daniel Bryan, and now it's Cody Rhodes. And none of the men who did it were even in the company anymore 10 years later. So like when it comes to guessing who's going to be standing tall at the end of WrestleMania 50, like who do you think it's going to be? I can't even give you an answer because chances are, if history is any indication, like when 20 rolled around, Bret wasn't there. When 30 rolled around, Benoit was gone for obvious reasons. When 40 rolled around, Daniel Bryan is rolling around in an AEW ring. You know, when WrestleMania 50 comes, it's probably going to be somebody who is not even in the company right now. So this definitely felt a little self-indulgent when it came to the Rock stuff. They could have included more comments from people like Roman and Seth. They didn't break a lot of new ground. If you already knew the basic gist of how everything played out, I don't think you're going to learn a whole hell of a lot from this. But if you've got 60 minutes to spare and you enjoy the behind-the-scenes footage, that usually is my favorite part of these documentaries, just seeing some of the backstage stuff. You get a lot of that in this, then I would say give it a watch. At Forbidden Door last Sunday, Will Ospreay and Swerve Strickland had one of the best matches that you will see all year, with Swerve handing Ospreay his first loss since coming to AEW. Ospreay proved Swerve right in the match when he told him, coming into it, that he didn't have the killer instinct to be the champion. Ospreay opted not to use the Tiger Driver 91 during the match, and then later on, when Don Callis handed him a screwdriver to use, he tossed it aside. Then on Dynamite, Ospreay told Callis respectfully that he no longer wants to be part of his family. And Callis said, well, I don't usually let someone out of a signed agreement, but he agreed to let him go. And you just know that it's all going to come back to bite Ospreay on the ass. But Fightful reported this week that the match at Forbidden Door came about because Ospreay wanted to eliminate the talking point of Swerve being a placeholder for him until All In. And he also wanted to lead by example that nobody should have an issue losing to the world champion. I don't know if this means for sure that Tony Khan had a different main event in mind for Forbidden Door and he went with Swerve and Ospreay only because Ospreay went to him and suggested it. Or maybe he was already leaning that way. That wasn't clear to me. But that's why this is the guy you build your company around. We need more people in wrestling who think like Will Ospreay does. He said everybody's assuming that Swerve is dropping that belt to me at Wembley, and he's not dropping that belt to me at Wembley, and he's not even wrestling me at Wembley. And so, you know what? Let's do the match now and just shut that shit down, you know, and I'll lose to him and really cement the fact that this guy is the man. You know, he's the champ, and people should see him that way and not as somebody just keeping the title warm for me. You know, he put his own ego aside, and he did what was right for the company. I think they need more people like that. But it became a lot clearer on Wednesday what the direction is for Ospreay at All In. After he beat Daniel Garcia to retain the international title, MJF, who was ringside in Garcia's corner and tried helping him by feeding him the Dynamite Diamond ring to use, which he refused to do, MJF got in the ring and kicked Garcia low, kicked him in the nuts, and then he beat the living crap out of him and he bloodied this poor kid until eventually Ospreay returned, and by that point, MJF hightailed it into the crowd. So we have MJF back as a full-fledged heel, which is the right move. It kills the Adam Cole story, but that story was dead on arrival the minute that he laid out Cole at Double or Nothing. Right? He laid him out. He told security, get this shit stain out of my ring. That's where it ended. The Undisputed Kingdom was an undisputed bust. And it was ruined by injuries to the only two people that really mattered in this entire angle. You know, when you have one guy disappearing for months and the other one being carted around in a wheelchair every week, there isn't a whole lot that you can do. And it's not as if they kept the rest of the group looking, you know, overly strong. I mean, where's Wardlow at? Where's he at, by the way? What's he been up to? It's dead. It was time for MJF to move on to something else. He also now has plenty of people to work with on the babyface side, you know, Ospreay being chief among them. But when Garcia comes back, that's another match. I think they should save that for All Out in Chicago. They could revisit the MJF Swerve Strickland match that they teased at the end of last year. MJF and Adam Copeland when he comes back. That's a match they haven't done. You know, they knew they were up against Money in the Bank last night, so they advertised MJF opening Collision with his first promo, his first words after the heel turn, which was about as good of a hook as they could possibly do. I mean, last night was going to be tough for them no matter what they put on that show. I did watch it, though. I liked the approach that he took in the promo, making it about the fans and how they treated him after he finally opened up to them last year. It was last August, talking about, you know, when he was younger, kids throwing quarters at him and telling him to pick them up, and how he learned that he had to stab people in the back before they had a chance to do the same thing to him. And he changed for all of us. He let his guard down. He destroyed his body for us. And how did the fans repay him? After his best friend stabs him in the back, Samoa Joe steals his belt. And while he is sitting at home on his couch, convalescing, in pain, he hears the fans chanting, "Thank you, Joe." He said the fans cast him aside for people like Swerve Strickland and Will Ospreay. What he did to Daniel Garcia, who he was never really going to wrestle at Wembley Stadium, he said, what he did to him had less to do with Garcia and more to do with the fans. He's going to take away everything that the fans love in this company because everything the fans love sucks. So the fans ruined the company that he helped build with their horrible taste in wrestling, but he'll fix it and he'll start with Will Ospreay. And so I thought, as explanations go, this one works really well because that's exactly what happened. He reluctantly opened himself up to be liked by the fans. He was pandering to the fans, the kangaroo kick stuff. And in the end, they turned their backs on him like they do everybody else. Because let's be honest here, it's the fans who are the real heels. We are the villains in this story, time and time again. Bryan Danielson said it best many years ago, fickle. The fans are a fickle bunch. So I thought it was a very plausible explanation. He said the fans' taste in wrestling sucks and he's going to do all he can to fight against it. Good. Hopefully that means no more dives. Because when he went babyface, he started doing dives out of the ring. He tried wrestling like everybody else on that roster and that's why he got hurt. No more leaping, running cutters over the top rope. Leave that to Ricochet when he comes in. MJF and Ricochet, by the way, there's another great match for down the road. Because Ricochet represents everything that MJF despises about pro wrestling. To no one's surprise, Hangman Adam Page turned out to be the wild card in the Owen Hart Foundation tournament. He has a new brooding theme song, and he is as pissed off and angry as ever before. The match with Jeff Jarrett on Wednesday was a lot better than I was expecting it to be. It was very competitive, more competitive than some people would have liked, but you know, Jarrett had a personal reason for being in the tournament, and what he gave you was everything that he's got left. So he put up a good fight, but it still wasn't enough, and Hangman Page rightly picks up the win and moves on to the next round against Switchblade Jay White on Collision last night. And they, too, had a very good match. Hangman wins again. The Young Bucks announced before the match, right before the match, that Juice Robinson and the Guns would have to leave ringside. And Jay White did not like that very much. So what's going on here is the Bucks are really sucking up to Hangman to try to get back in his good graces, but it does not appear to be working. Because he was their pick to be the wild card. And then on Wednesday, they tried to recruit him to be their fifth man in Blood and Guts, which is really what this is all about. But he rebuffed them. He even said last night, they only brought me back from my suspension when it was convenient for them. He said he's not back for them. He's back to burn through this tournament and right a wrong that should have been righted a long time ago against Swerve. He's going to do that at All In. He's going to burn that man's world down to the ground. To do that, he's going to have to beat Bryan Danielson on Wednesday in Calgary in the finals. And there is some intrigue there because I could see either one of these two men wrestling Swerve at Wembley Stadium. I've been saying Hangman for weeks now, and I still feel that way. But if they wanted to give Danielson one last chance to win the world title before he retires full-time, they can tell that story. Tony Khan made a lot of money off Sting's final match at Revolution and gave him one of the greatest send-offs any wrestler has ever gotten. Maybe the greatest send-off ever. He may want to do the same thing for Bryan Danielson, even though he's not really retiring. He's just not going to wrestle as often. I mean, Danielson has said he will never retire. If it's up to him, he will always wrestle at some point in some form or fashion, even if it's one match a year. He's not retiring, but as a full-time performer, he is. So it's like WWE now has this John Cena retirement tour that they've announced next year, and I just told you guys before, we were talking about potential ideas, and does Cena go after number 17? So you're talking about possibly doing the same story with John Cena in WWE. This could be his last chance. I mean, this is going to be his last chance. If he wants to be world champion again, it's 2025 or bust. Similar story here with Bryan Danielson. If he's hanging it up full time and he's not going to be wrestling for championships anymore, this is it. This will be their one and only shot to put him in position to become world heavyweight champion, which, you know, he has said in interviews he actually does not want. he's blown the whole angle. He said, look, I can't be that guy in the pay-per-view main events anymore. It takes a toll on my body. You know, I don't want to be world champion at this point. I don't need to be world champion at this point. But that is one story that they could tell. I think the match should be Swerve and Hangman. It's a much more personal issue with a much better story. And I would not split the crowd for Swerve. They already did that at Forbidden Door. I think it's better to put him in there against a strong heel. I also think that if and when we come to find out that Swerve is going to be representing Team AEW in Blood and Guts, which why would he not? He's the champion. You already left him out of Anarchy in the Arena. Why the hell would he not be on Team AEW? I mean, he's Mr. AEW. He's the AEW World Champion. He has insulted the Young Bucks. Why would he not be in Blood and Guts? Right now, Mark Briscoe is the only name official on Team AEW. Once Swerve gets in there, and he will, he'll be the team captain. Once that happens, that may be what finally gets Hangman to change his mind and agree to be the fifth man for the Elite. So I wouldn't necessarily go fishing for who can the fifth man be? If it's not going to be Hangman, who's it going to be? You know, could it be MJF? I suppose it's possible. You have Swerve and Ospreay as partners on Team AEW. That's possible too, but I don't think you need to waste too much energy thinking about who the fifth man is going to be. I still think it probably ends up being Hangman Page. But the lineup for Dynamite this Wednesday looks like this. We have Swerve back on the show for the first time since Forbidden Door. Will Ospreay will respond to MJF. We have the Women's Owen Hart Tournament Final with Mariah May taking on Willow Nightingale. And the Men's Owen Hart Final with Bryan Danielson against Hangman Adam Page. Samoa Joe is wrestling The Learning Tree, Chris Jericho, in a Stampede street fight. If he doesn't hit him with a tree, I'm going to be very upset. And Claudio Castagnoli takes on Tomohiro Ishii, who takes on Kyle Fletcher, who takes on Pac in what they are calling a Global Glory four-way. The Forbidden Door is open every week. What did I tell you? This is one of the reasons why Forbidden Door doesn't feel quite as special as it did in year one. We get the Forbidden Door every week. We got Ishii back on the show this week. Also on Dynamite this past week, we had Britt Baker, who made her return at Forbidden Door. She's been out since September with a bad back and a torn hip labrum. But it was actually worse than anyone even knew. She was on Dynamite for the first time with a live mic, and she revealed that last November, she suffered what's called a TIA, which is basically a mini stroke, which is caused by a blockage of blood to the brain. It doesn't last very long, and it doesn't typically cause any long-term damage, but it can be a sign that you will eventually have a full-blown stroke. It happens at about 30% of cases, which is very scary to hear at any age, let alone when you're 33 years old like she is. But she has since been medically cleared, and this brought Mercedes Moné out to the ring for her championship celebration. She now has the TBS title and the New Japan Strong women's title, and Mercedes was booed heavily, as she was at Forbidden Door. And she was booed and playing the role of heel, which is the right role for her to be playing. Britt challenged her to a match at All In and said that she wrestled at the first All In Chicago, and she wrestled at last year's All In at Wembley Stadium while Mercedes was sitting in the stands like a broken bitch with a broken leg. And Mercedes never outright said yes. She spit out some catchphrases, but of course it's going to happen at All In. It is the biggest match they could do right now with the ladies. The battle between the face of the women's division then and now. And they gave them way more time than Tony usually does on these Wednesday shows with the women, especially for a promo. They were out there for a long time. So Tony Khan now has MJF, Hangman Page, and Britt Baker back on the active roster just in time for his biggest show of the year. The only name missing from that list is Kenny Omega. And it would have been great to have him back in time for a match with Okada at Wembley, but I don't think there's any shot of that happening. Speaking of Mercedes, one last note here. PW Insider has confirmed with multiple sources, this was a big story early in the week that people let their imaginations run wild as to what it all means. But PW Insider said that Mercedes Moné was seen on Monday with Shane McMahon at LaGuardia Airport in New York. We are told that each were seen speaking on their way to their respective flights. One source, when PW Insider reached out to confirm whether the story was true, confirmed that they did have a conversation about AEW. There had been rumors of Shane McMahon's alleged interest in AEW in recent weeks, with Tony Khan noting recently that he would be open to speaking with McMahon. Well, Mercedes herself later confirmed PW Insider's report. She has a newsletter, for those who don't know. And in her newsletter, she wrote, "I walked into the airport, was in line by the bagel shop when I suddenly looked up, and there he was, just as surprised as I was. My first day being a double title holder and the first wrestler and former WWE superstar I see is McMahon. Come on, if that isn't the universe working in divine timing, I don't know what else it could be. I've always loved Shane. When we locked eyes, we both kind of looked at each other like, is that you? Our faces lit up as we got to talking a little bit, and before he boarded his flight, he gave me his number. The rest, as they say, is history or maybe a mystery." Again, we do not need Shane McMahon in AEW. I'm like Bart Simpson writing on the blackboard. We do not need Shane McMahon in AEW. We do not need Shane McMahon in AEW. Maybe if I say it enough times, it'll be etched into a stone tablet. Let's get to your mailbag questions. If you have questions for me, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Let's start here with Jonathan from Charlotte, North Carolina. "With MJF turning heel and injuring Daniel Garcia, I was thinking of ways that you could do the MJF and Ospreay feud that could help Garcia get over. I would have MJF cheat to beat Ospreay for the international title at All In. which would get him great heat since Ospreay is the hometown boy. Then on the Dynamite after, I would have Garcia return from injury and challenge MJF for the title, with the justification being that he tried making his life miserable. Now he's going to do the same by taking the title. This would lead to a match at All Out, where Daniel Garcia beats MJF for the International Championship, perhaps after some assistance from Ospreay. Ideally, the best way to get Garcia over is to have him beat MJF clean at All Out, but I struggle envisioning that, especially if MJF cheats Ospreay out of his title. In this scenario, the MJF and Ospreay feud would continue past All In, but without the title involved. Nevertheless, I think a win over MJF would be a good way to firmly establish Daniel Garcia as being in the mix. Yeah, I mean, MJF against Garcia at All Out in Chicago is the same idea that I pitched. You know, you go MJF and Ospreay at Wembley, and then 2 weeks later, you do MJF against Garcia. Your idea of having MJF beat Ospreay for the belt and then drop it to Garcia 2 weeks later also works great. I like it. And I think a win over MJF would be, I mean, it'd be the biggest win of his career. If MJF and Ospreay continue their feud, you know, it's not like they need the international title. And clean would be ideal. It's hard for me to envision him just cleanly beating MJF, though. So even if there's an assist in there from Will Ospreay, yeah, it might not be ideal, but that could be their out. You know, and Garcia still gets his big win. And now he's taken, Will has taken now something away from MJF, and it gives them a reason to run it back again. Paolo from Milan. I've been thinking about the direction for the bloodline and reaching Cody against Randy. Solo pins Cody at Money in the Bank to set up a title match at SummerSlam that Solo wins, with all of the bloodline interference to help him. Solo then goes out on TV as champion and continues to diminish Roman, while Jacob Fatu and the Tongans get wins of their own. At the Solo-Cody rematch in Berlin, cue the same interference, but Roman returns and takes out Solo while Randy does the final drop on Fatu, and the title falls back on Cody. On the next SmackDown, Cody tells Randy he'll show his appreciation for all of his help and gives him a Rolex or a car, but Randy doesn't care for all that and drops Cody where he stands. What say you? I'd drop him where he stands too if he tried to pull that shit on me. I think if you want to turn Cody Rhodes heel, then yes, he should offer Randy Orton a Rolex or a car. Like, what an epic douchebag he would come across as in that scenario. Like, can you see what I'm talking about? Like, how badly that would make Cody Rhodes look? I don't want to see Solo Sikoa as WWE champion. I think that would be a bad way to end SummerSlam. Look at the way they ended Money in the Bank. You know, you're just going to have him beat Cody again and just go off the air like that? No Roman Reigns, no nothing? You can't end SummerSlam that way. Roman needs to return at SummerSlam. Not in Berlin. Has to be at SummerSlam. You shoot that angle before it even gets to the point that Solo would win the title. As far as getting to Cody and Randy, again, they did nothing at Money in the Bank to give you the impression that Randy is about to turn on him or, you know, drop him with an RKO. It's going to happen at some point, but it just doesn't look like it's in the cards. You know, we have to get past SummerSlam first, and then we'll see. You know, could we get Cody and Randy in Berlin? Yeah, I think it's possible. I think Randy should be the next challenger for Cody Rhodes. Chris from Bethlehem. With Charles Robinson just turning 60 this week. Can you believe that? Lil Nate is 60 years old. Says, where do you rank him with all of the other WWE officials? Also, in 2014, while traveling with the WWE in Saudi Arabia, Robinson suffered a freak accident while helping assemble the ring, resulting in him nearly losing his thumb. Do you know what happened there? Yeah, he got his thumb caught in the turnbuckle and almost severed it right off. But Lil Nate is great. You know, he was a memorable referee in WCW, and he transitioned to WWE better than any of their other referees did. In fact, I think he may be the only one who still works there. I know Nick Patrick did for a while, Mickey J. Billy Silverman didn't last very long. You could thank JBL for that. Still makes me mad to think back to the stories that he told of what those guys did to Robinson after he came over from WCW. Just the way that they bullied him and they hazed him. I think they taped him naked to a chair and blindfolded him, I think, and rolled the chair out into the arena before the show. Like, just the stupid shit they did to this guy. And I'm pretty sure his wife was sick with cancer at the time. I don't think she passed away until later on, because he lost his wife. I want to say maybe it was 2002 that Charles Robinson lost his wife to cancer. But she may have already been sick at that point, so I'm sure he's got that on his mind. Like, what a bunch of fucking assholes, you know? But, you know, Robinson just sucked it up, and he took the hazing, and Billy Silverman reported it to management. Claims that management told him, just go along with it, tough it out. And Silverman said, fuck this, and he left. So he didn't last very long there, but, like, of all the people to bully, you're going to pick on Charles Robinson? I guess because he was small and he wasn't going to fight back. Of course, the famous story that Joey Styles did fight back one day. He punched JBL right in his fucking fat head. He didn't bother Joey after that. Anyway, I put Charles Robinson near the top of the list of all-time great referees. And if they ever put referees in their Hall of Fame, which they should, then he should be in there at some point. Devante from New York. If CM Punk doesn't get injured leading up to WrestleMania 40 and we end up with a match between CM Punk and Seth Rollins, or even a triple threat including McIntyre, how do you see the main events shaping up? Given how things were developing, do you think the night one main event would still be Cody and Rollins against Roman and Rock? Or would Punk versus Rollins, or the triple threat, become the main event for night one? Or is Punk versus Rollins added to night two as the opening match? No. If CM Punk does not get hurt in the Royal Rumble, he wrestles Seth Rollins for the World Heavyweight title in the main event of night one. Cody Rhodes ends up being held off the WrestleMania card with a storyline injury to explain why he would step aside to let Rock take his spot. And Drew McIntyre, up until a certain point, I was thinking that Drew McIntyre was going to be wrestling Sami Zayn, because they had mentioned the fact that Sami, he couldn't beat Drew. They were having issues on television. I thought it was going to be Sami finally getting a win over Drew instead of, you know, Sami against Gunther. Gunther ends up defending the Intercontinental title, I think, in that situation against Chad Gable, you know, with Brock Lesnar being out. And if Sami isn't an option, I think they do go with Gunther and Gable on that show. Kenny from Cottontown, Tennessee. Longtime listener for about a decade. You have become my fixture for Sunday Night Wrestling Audio, displacing Wrestling Observer and PW Torch Radio. Well, thank you, Kenny. I have a question for you about WCW since the Vice Who Killed WCW docuseries just aired. I felt that between this and WWE recently registering trademarks for WCW names. Yeah, I did see that. I know they registered a trademark for New Blood Rising. But anyway, would WCW work in 2024? Could we see a scenario where finally, 13 years later, Raw becomes WCW Raw when moving to Netflix? Or could it work as a standalone internet show? If it were me, I would consider WCW Raw on Netflix as a home for those that wouldn't quite work with the WWE style, but have enough of a unique feel that they could make it work, since you already have those that have a WCW feel in their work, like the Wyatt Six, Judgment Day, Seth Rollins, Chad Gable, Rhea Ripley, even Dominic Mysterio with the legacy of Rey Mysterio would make it feel like a WCW show. I have no idea how any of these people that you just mentioned outside of Rey have a WCW feel to that. What is even the WCW feel? But he says even a cameo from Eric Bischoff would bring the house down. What are your thoughts of a standalone WCW Raw show on Netflix in 2024? Pipe dream or possibility? Kenny, thank you for your kind words. The only house that Eric Bischoff is bringing down in 2024 is his own if he takes a sledgehammer to it. No, It is not even a remote possibility, nor should it be. First of all, the real issue here with what you've proposed, Netflix did not sign a $5 billion deal for Raw to end up with Nitro, a show that's been dead, by the way, for over 20 years. This would not work. It would be WCW in name only. It would not mean anything. And it's been dead and buried long enough that only the hardest of hardcore fans, I promise you, would even care about this. And even then, I bet you a lot of them wouldn't care. Most fans today, they have no concept of what WCW even was. They think WCW stands for Woman Crush Wednesday. They have no idea that it was a fucking wrestling company. Outside of a documentary here and there, they know about the Monday Night War, right? That's how they view WCW. They view it through that lens. But there is no war anymore. And a lot of what made WCW unique at that time, and we're going back fucking 30 years now, it's already been done so many times since then. There's nothing about it that would even be unique anymore. 3 hours, it's been done. Cruiserweights and luchadors, we see it every week on TV. What's so special about that? Rebooting WCW now would serve absolutely no purpose. Like, I get the nostalgia that people still have for it, but it's dead for a reason. It's like, it'd be like performing CPR on a cadaver. You just got to leave it alone. It doesn't work. Edward from the Mombasa coast of Kenya. Is it true that Y2J was supposed to be in the main event of WrestleMania 2000? And which year overall is better than 2000 creatively? Yes, he was in the promotional artwork for the show with Triple H, Rock, and Big Show, which would have been an awful coincidence if he was not originally supposed to be in that main event. Jim Ross has claimed that he was taken out because they feared him being in the ring with the other three would have exposed how small he was. Which is funny to me, you know, given that he eventually ended up working with all three of those guys anyway. Yeah, he worked a pay-per-view match with Triple H that summer. And it was great. And I don't, as far as your second question, I don't know. 2000's hard to beat. You know, 2024 is going pretty well right now, but the year's not over yet. So for me, it is still 2000. That is their greatest creative year. Miguel from San Marcos, Texas. What wrestlers in WWE that did not succeed in Vince McMahon's last 5 to 10 years would have if Triple H would have taken over creative 5 to 10 years earlier? Well, that is a loaded question. Adam Cole is the first name I thought of. Adam Cole, without question. Malachi Black, FTR, Tony Storm. I don't think Tony Storm would have walked out in that scenario. And he did succeed. I don't want to make it sound like I'm going to give a name to you right now. He did succeed. He had a lot of success. But I really think that if Vince McMahon was gone 5 to 10 years ago and Triple H was running things, John Moxley would never have left. And we would still have Dean Ambrose on TV. I can't put Keith Lee on the list because I think his health issues would have sidelined him regardless. But if he could have stayed healthy, then you could add Keith Lee to that list as well. James from Los Angeles. I was recently watching an ESPN documentary on Bo Jackson and how they marketed him considering his ability to play baseball and football at the pro level. I was wondering if WWF or WCW ever reached out to him to do wrestling. Had he done a program, who would he have done it with? Oh man, Bo Jackson, man, you're bringing back memories now. Bo knows. I'm not aware of them ever reaching out to Bo Jackson or him even having an interest in doing pro wrestling. If he did anything with WCW, I'm sure he would have been working with Hulk Hogan. You know, Hogan would have wanted to work with him. If they were bringing in a celebrity of any note, you can be sure that Hulk Hogan was going to be the one working with him, right? Just like he did with Dennis Rodman and Karl Malone and Jay Leno. He didn't work with David Arquette, but he didn't work with David Arquette because he was smart enough not to. Isaac from Brantford, Ontario, Canada. Who do you think would have been a bigger signing for TNA Wrestling back in 2008? Brock Lesnar or Adam Copeland? Brock Lesnar. I know Copeland was a champion at that time in WWF or WWE, I guess. I'm still calling it WWF. My God, what year is it? I still catch myself sometimes. I'm a lot better at it than I used to be, but I still catch myself calling it WWF. I know Edge was champion that year, and he was on TV. Brock Lesnar wasn't. This was during a period where Brock was gone from the company. He had been gone for 4 years at that point. I don't even know. 2008, did he compete in UFC at that point? I don't think so, right? I don't think he fought in UFC until 2010. I still feel like Brock Lesnar would have been the bigger signing. And just from an athletic perspective, I mean, the guy was a freak athlete. For a whole host of reasons, I think Brock Lesnar would have been a bigger signing than Copeland in 2008. Dolphin from Australia. I was shocked when looking at Kane's wrestling history and seeing that he only had a single WWF championship run that lasted for all but 24 hours. The aura of Kane was always going to disappear eventually, but he was a big deal during the Attitude Era. Is there a year where you could have seen Kane in the Royal Rumble winning and then winning the championship, or, well, he says, and then go, I guess, going on to the championship main event at WrestleMania? Well, either way, the answer is no. Kane was awesome. Kane was never that character, though, that was going to win the Royal Rumble and go to the main event of WrestleMania. He just, that's not what that character was built to be. He was never going to be the face of the company. He literally had no face. You know, he had a mask, and he did not need to win the Royal Rumble and have his journey to WrestleMania. You're talking about an Attitude Era where he wasn't even really speaking. You know, he really wasn't cutting promos until probably 2002. Maybe 01. I don't remember him even doing a lot of talking in 01. So I can't imagine that version of Kane, that like original dominant version of Kane, being in the position that guys like John Cena and Hogan and Austin were in. Like, that's not Kane. Dylan from Toronto. On a recent stream, you mentioned a tag team Iron Man match and how none had come to pass. It made me wonder, what would be your dream tag team Iron Man match? You can book any two tag teams from any promotion across all eras. They will wrestle for 60 minutes. Bret and Owen Hart against Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit. That would have been my fantasy tag team Iron Man match. David from Newark, New Jersey. Buy or sell on who you think was a better heel, Triple H in 2000 or Hollywood Rock in 2003. I'm going to buy on Triple H in 2000. I loved Hollywood Rock. Hollywood Rock was very entertaining in a way that I think had some people cheering for him. Triple H in 2000 was the consummate heel. There was nothing to cheer for. He was the ultimate bad guy. And he did a very good job of it. You know, him and Rock both carried that company for most of that year. So I got to go Triple H on this one. John from New Jersey, would love your take on this. Suppose Bret Hart stays with the WWF, even if Vince can't pay him what he promised before, and the screw job never happens. Where do you think WWE business goes from there? You probably don't have the meteoric rise of Mr. McMahon, but also Bret Hart doesn't get injured by Goldberg. Yeah, Bret doesn't get kicked in the head by Goldberg, and he can retire on his own terms. That's one of the greatest tragedies of the whole situation, that he was forced out of the ring before he was ready for it to be over. And we were deprived of Bret sharing the ring with men like Kurt Angle and Randy Orton and Chris Jericho and Brock Lesnar. The greatest tragedy, though, is that if Bret stays, I 100% believe that Owen Hart would still be alive today. AEW would not be doing an Owen Hart Foundation tournament. There would be no Owen Hart Foundation. Owen would still be on this earth. Because he would not have been, I don't even think he would have been doing the Blue Blazer gimmick again in the first place. In the short term, I've always believed that had Bret stayed, he would have finally put Steve Austin over clean for the title at WrestleMania 14. I think we would have eventually gotten the Mr. McMahon character regardless as a way to help elevate Austin. Remember, the first Stunner to Vince had already happened in September of 97. That was 2 months before the screw job. So I think they would have gone with the boss versus employee stuff regardless, especially with Vince seeing Eric Bischoff making himself such a focal part of the show on Nitro. I don't think he would have been able to help himself. You know, he already had a little heel run in Memphis back in 93 that a lot of people don't know about. I think Austin versus McMahon was always inevitable. And with the rise of The Rock in Austin, WWE would have overtaken WCW exactly the way that they did. You know, WCW was going down the tubes regardless for all the reasons they did. They were going to mismanage themselves into oblivion regardless. Brett staying with Vince doesn't change any of that. Thank you guys for the questions. A lot of good stuff here. Keep emailing me, please. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter. @Solomonster is where I am most active. And of course, on YouTube, you can subscribe to the YouTube channel. Tons of content, live and otherwise, always going up weekly on the YouTube channel. We are very close to 81,000 subscribers. We are closing in on 80,900. And then we only need 100 more and we hit 81K. I can't get there without you. So please go and subscribe to the channel. You can find me live every Monday and Wednesday and usually on Fridays. I don't know that I'll be live this Friday. I won't know for sure until the end of the week, but I will keep you guys posted. You can find me live on YouTube on JD's channel for Tuesday Night Titans every Tuesday at 8:30. We've had some bang-up discussions over the last couple of weeks. I hope you guys are enjoying that. We have much to talk about again this week. Feels like we always have much to talk about. I think every show we've done so far has been at least 3 hours long. And we always tell each other, like, okay, we're not going to go 3 hours tonight. Let's try to keep it tight, two and a half. And then we wrap up and I'm like, fuck, 3 hours and 17 minutes and it doesn't even feel like it. So catch those discussions every Tuesday on TNT. If you missed the Money in the Bank review, go check out that video as well up on the YouTube channel. I will be pushing the audio out. I know I talked about it here today, but the full review, you guys can catch that very soon, if not by the time you listen to this on all of the usual podcast platforms. I will see you back here next Sunday. That is going to be episode 870 of the Solomonster Sounds Off. Thank you guys, as always, for all the love and support. And we'll do it all over again next Sunday. So until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
So if you're not hacked, hop on X. All these wrestlers getting hacked. You know, I used to make fun of the wrestlers who would post something really fucking stupid, and then they would be like, oh, I got hacked. It's like, no, you didn't. But now they really are. Now they really are getting hacked. Well, what is their password? Like Hulk Hogan, for example. What is his password? Brother? Lex Luger, what's your password? Total package? Maybe it's a wrestler thing. Kevin says I would laugh my ass off if that isn't Hogan's password. I'm telling you, I guarantee you, Hogan's password was either brother, dude, or Jack. And then he got fucking hacked. Change your password.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster Sounds Off.